Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this afternoon, Co-Chairman Hoffman, Vice Chairman Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Stevens, and Senator Olson. On today's agenda is a presentation from Commissioner Fisher and Tax Director Ken Alper on SB 4001, the employment tax. It is 1:35 p.m. Again, Thursday, November 9th. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite Director Alper and Commissioner Fisher to the microphone. If you could identify yourself for the record so those following us at home can hear your voice, and I would ask members of the public who are following us at home, I'll direct your attention to a PowerPoint online called New Sustainable Alaska Plan, Pulling Together to Build Our Future, Capped Payroll Tax Bill Introduction, SB 4001, by Governor Walker, dated November 9th, 2017. Welcome to Senate Finance, gentlemen.
Thank you. I'm Sheldon Fisher. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and pleased to be here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue, and I want to make the committee aware of Deputy Director Brandon Spanos, who's sitting behind me in the first row, who might get called up as a lifeline if the questions get a little technical.
Welcome to Senate Finance, sir.
Thank you.
Do you have some opening comments before you present SB 4001?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Sheldon Fisher again, and I think that we're pleased to make this presentation. We appreciate the time that you have allocated to us. I think that there's a lot of conversation, and we heard you've had us here before. You've had Director Pitney. You had David Teal here earlier. And I think that if there's one thing I would say to this committee and also say to the public, it's that I think there's too much uncertainty in Alaska. We've got a $2.5 billion deficit, and it's stalling investment in the state. It is, I think it's prompting people to hold back in terms of economic activity, and I think it's critical as we think about this plan and think about the various options that are available to us to try to come up with a solution, whatever that solution may be, that we can be unified between both branches of both chambers as well as the administration, so that we take some of that uncertain overhang from the state. And I just would invite you to think about this presentation in that context. We have attempted to create a structure that we think is a compromise. We're willing even to move and adjust from what's being presented here, but I think it's quite important that we not repeat the challenges we've had the last few sessions, where it seems like we emerge from the session with really no consensus on how we're going to fund state government. And I would just invite everyone as they think about this and think about where we've come from and where we are to consider this presentation in that light.
Commissioner, I do want to publicly acknowledge that Co-Chairman Hoffman, Majority Leader Machicki, and I had a conversation with your team asking for as much information as possible to make good decisions about this particular bill, in the sense of asking for an advancement of the revenue forecast book for DNR to share the new revenue projections in relationship to price and production, that we really are trying to establish what the gap looks like and then what the variation on that financial gap would look like. So, as you've said to us before, that we can have a common agreement on at least the facts and the knobs that are turning that show this projected $2.5 billion revenue shortfall.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't have much by way of opening comment. I would like to acknowledge my own staff, particularly the Economic Research Group, who put in a lot of extra hours in the week leading up to this special session to do a preliminary fall revenue forecast, to put together the production information that we were just freshly getting from DNR, plug it through a lot of modeling, a lot of formulas, to be able to bring the latest possible information to this and other committees in advance to put our bill in the proper context.
Thank you. And we just to note for the general public, you have warned us that some of those items could change because you were pressing to get us that information early. So at least I can speak for myself that that will not be held against you if you find something that needs to be changed. We just need to be aware of why that change takes place and how it affects what we've heard before.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to tip off the committee on one thing to expect when the fall forecast comes, and with the revenue source book, the volume, the longer document, Chapter 3, which is our special purpose narrative chapter, is going to be on the subject of oil price forecasting and some of the nuance and uncertainty that's an inherently part of that art.
Director Alper, we appreciate that. I know that there's some national models and international models that are out there that project price significantly higher than the department, so I know you'll be prepared to discuss that. I know that when Senator Dunleavy was at this table, that he specifically asked why we were expending state dollars to arrive at a decision that the international market was establishing a price with. So we'll look forward to that discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But we'll try to keep this to the bill before you. I was talking to your aide earlier. This is a very similar presentation to what we delivered in the other body's Finance Committee earlier in the special session. There's a few slides we've sort of compressed out of it now that more information has been said. The parts that talk about the how and the what and what the bill does are pretty much the same. You don't need as much of the backstory on the why. We're coming up with this shape bill, this amount of money. I believe from what you've heard from Mr. Teal, Ms. Pitney, Commissioner Fisher in the past, your committee's very up to speed on where the state's fiscal situation is at. So with that, the bill title, a tax on wages and net earnings from self-employment, administration thereof. It's a relatively thin bill. I'll get into some of the nuance of it later on. It is very closely modeled in a lot of its administrative structure on a bill from a member of this committee, from Senator Bishop, Senate Bill 12, the so-called school head tax. Although the mechanism of the tax formula is a little bit different, much of the administrative guts and the taxability, the issue of wages and self-employment, were taken from that structure that Senator Bishop brought forward. This is a chart that Director Pitney brought up in her earlier presentation, and you could see, the expenditures have declined dramatically from the peak of 2013. They simply have not been able to do so at nearly the rate that our revenue dropped, coming from a peak in 2012 of over 80%. And if you were to isolate that on just the oil and gas revenue, the revenue fell by about 90%. The consensus of much of the body and the administration is that in some way permanent fund earnings will obviously, in a structured way, be able to fill the bulk of that gap. In case it is incapable of doing so, some small revenue measure to fill the rest of the gap and provide some certainty that we can balance the budget going forward, we believe is necessary. This bill is our proposal to fill the rest of that gap, presuming again that the permanent fund can't quite get us all the way there. Madam Chair, slide 5 just looks at the decline in oil revenues, the general fund oil revenues over the last 8-9 years, and how the budget has also declined, but you can see the peak of 2012, $8.9 billion, down to less than $1 billion in 2017. That's a 90% decrease in oil and gas revenue. Obviously, that could not be adjusted with a 90% decline to the budget. The budget declines have been substantial, but still we're looking at moving from an era of budget surpluses in excess of $2 billion a year to budget deficits of $2 or $3 or even higher billion dollars per year in our recent history. And 2.5 is the estimate based on the current year. Obviously, we don't have the final numbers on FY18 yet because we are still in the middle of the year. Slide number 6 is slightly new information. I've shown similar information before. This is what the state's budget looks like going back to 1975, the year construction started ramping up on TAPS. The blue is operating, the red, what we call statewide operating, things like debt service and pension payments and oil and gas tax credits fall in that category, revenue sharing, and then the green is the capital budget. And what's interesting about this data set is that it's adjusted for inflation and also for population growth. So this is per capita real dollars spent per year. You could see, obviously, the peak of the early oil years, then coming down with the collapse in oil prices in the mid-80s, and a similar, although not quite as high, peak in the 2010s, and then coming down in recent years. The what we have cut down to is, in many ways, lower than what we've seen throughout most of the modern oil-producing history of Alaska. There were a few years in the later 90s and early 2000s where we were lower on a dollar-for-dollar basis than we are now. But for the most part, we've gotten close to historic lows. And then there's another wrinkle, and that's the new data in this slide. The data only goes back to 1985, but I think it's very telling. Carving out the education funding from the state health care funding from what we'll call other, from the regular agency budgets of the state of Alaska. And the lightest blue wedge I want to draw the committee's attention to, that is health spending. That's obviously something outside our control, but health has inflated much larger than underlying inflation, and that wedge has gotten quite thicker over the years. Consequently, the other agency budget, that what people think of as the bureaucracy, has gotten much smaller over those years, simply because it has. We are doing more with fewer people and less resources, and everything from revenue, transportation, courts, the legislature itself, and all of that. And I might, depending on how the questions go, refer back to this slide later in the presentation. So, Madam Chair, moving to slide 7, and I said this a little bit before, we believe that there will be continued deficits even after relatively aggressive use of permanent fund earnings within a sustainable framework, and we are presuming something close to what the Senate passed in Senate Bill 26, where 75% of the sustainable draw would go to the general fund. Even with that, we see ongoing deficits in the $500 or $600 million range. The bill before you would fill about half of that gap. It's $320 million, and that would give us the flexibility to at least slow the drain of remaining reserves, or if things work in our favor even a little bit, actually balance the budget. It buys the state, frankly, time. The danger is, although the permanent fund goes a long way, and it's important to acknowledge that the permanent fund continues to grow over time due to inflation and due to new deposits from oil production, that means that the annual draw will grow and the gap will shrink over time, but in the meantime, the additional amount is likely coming from remaining savings, and this bill buys the state time. It extends our runway by several years.
If we could pause for a moment. Senator Von Imhoff.
When he's finished with the slide, then I'll ask about a particular bullet.
Are you finished with the slide?
I was not, Madam Chair, but I will be in just a minute. It is our concern that the CBRF is highly stressed. Director Pitney has talked about the need to keep a couple of billion dollars in there. If that couple of billion dollars is spent and there isn't even that sort of flexibility and we don't have a balanced budget in 3 or 4 years, what exactly are our options? And I've said informally to some members, we view this bill as a form of insurance, as a backup plan just in case we run out of our other sources of money, that we're not in the relatively desperate straits of having to overdraw the permanent fund. I appreciated, Madam Chair, your comments to Mr. Thiel this morning that unstructured draws are really the worst of all worlds. So now I am done, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Director Alper. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Director Alper, on the third bullet point, a tax combined with permanent fund restructuring and continued budget discipline, can you expand and describe what your vision of continued budget discipline is, please?
So, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'm not the only budget that I'm personally responsible is the budget of my own small agency in the Department of Revenue. And I know that in that context, we are constantly cutting corners, looking for efficiencies, reducing staff. We're down something between 15% and 20% staff-wise. There's always a better way to do something, and I like to hope that every other director and every other agency is trying to cut those corners. I know that the governor's office, Director Pitney, the commissioner, are putting together a budget for next year. I'm frankly not closely part of that process, and I hope that they will be finding the kinds of efficiencies that I know that you're looking for. I believe Commissioner Fisher has something he'd like to add.
Commissioner Fisher.
Thank you. This is Sheldon Fisher. All I would say is that with the budget more or less flat or even some reductions year over year from FY18, the permanent fund, the POMV, and the revenue proposals that we've proposed still leave hundreds of millions of dollars of unfunded spending. And so that's, to me, that's the discipline that we're talking about. This tax doesn't fully fund our need, at least the need as defined by what we did last year. And so I think it's going to be incumbent upon us as an administration and upon the legislature to continue the focus on reducing cost. I think I've expressed before one of the big drivers is healthcare, and I would hope that that's a conversation that in regular session we'll spend a fair amount of time talking about how we handle healthcare costs. And there's a report that the Department of Administration published over the summer that will be germane to that conversation. But I think the message is we understand that there is an expectation, I think, from this committee, from the Senate as a whole, from the legislature, from the public, that there's a desire to see future budget discipline in the way government is operated and managed, and we agree with that.
Senator Von Imhoff, earlier today during a discussion, you talked about the average inflation in the Anchorage area. I didn't know if you wanted to put that on the record since they were your comments at an earlier discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of the continued budget discipline, David Teal did indicate that in his modeling, with inflation at essentially a five-year trailing CPI, which is about a 1.3%, which is what we had, I believe, in Senate Bill 26, we as in the Senate passed, it yields for a much more balanced budget overall, particularly in the future years, than the assumptions of a higher growth rate. So the discipline is not only in reductions for a starting point, but future growth.
Through the chair, I listened to that and I heard that comment, and I think that there's a lot of wisdom in that. I guess I think I don't know that maybe we're saying similar things or close to the same thing. I think that looking backwards, we have just gone through a period of low inflation on a nationwide basis. Looking forward, I think that we expect, and I don't mean just the administration, I think most economists and the professionals in the industry expect that future years we're going to, as a country, experience higher rates of inflation. And certainly David Teal's own expectations in terms of return on the permanent fund actually reflect that higher rate of inflation, because the permanent fund is CPI plus 4.5, and so built into that is something in the neighborhood of 2 to 2.5% inflation is kind of the numbers that are expected. So, but if your point is we ought to, as a state, continue to be disciplined in our spending, we agree with you.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you both for being here. Thank you, Madam Chair. Both of you talked about a budget deficit, but neither of you discussed it as a likely temporary situation. Could you touch on that a bit? When you talked about an insurance policy, was that to manage a dip, or is that something that you see as being something that's going to exist into the distant future?
So through the chair, this is Sheldon Fisher again. No, I think we agree in our modeling that we've shared with some of you and Director Pitney reviewed in her presentation to this committee last week, envisions and the new revenue forecast that we have show that in the out years, kind of 7, 8, 9 years out, the budget goes back into balance and we can actually start to replenish some of our reserves. And so it's a great point that we believe that there is a need for additional taxes for a period of time, or additional revenue, I should say, for a period of time to bridge that gap until we emerge from the other side. If we don't have those, our modeling suggests that there's a likelihood that the permanent fund will be negatively impacted, that our reserves will decline, and that it will actually harm future revenue sources or income sources in those future years. And so a number of people, and I think we've said this publicly to the House, have suggested that they would like to see some sort of sunsetting on the revenue, and that's on any revenue measure, and that's something we're very open to having that conversation if that's where the legislature would like to go.
Senator, can I just add one small thing to that?
Director Alper.
Commissioner's comments talking about the budget coming into balance in a few years presumes the passage of a permanent fund restructuring bill comparable to Senate Bill 26. In the absence of any use of permanent fund earnings, the underlying modeling shows a structural deficit that stays in the $2 or $2.5 billion range for years to come.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Alper.
Madam Chair, I'm really glad you mentioned unstructured draws this morning. This is another slide that we borrowed from OMB, and more or less it said if we start taking from the earnings reserve more than the amount that's the sustainable draw that keeps the fund balance whole, the real value whole over time, what that will do is inevitably start reducing the amount that's used to calculate future annual draws, percent of market value draws, as the fund itself declines. And this is the impact of taking simply $500 million per year in excess of the agreed-upon sustainable number, and how that becomes a form of compound interest in reverse. So you get to 2027, and the permanent fund itself is actually negatively impacted to the tune of about $5 billion, implying roughly $300 million per year in lower ongoing draws that could come off of it, which inevitably, and we're going to have to be met with even more cuts and or additional revenue.
Mr. Helper, it begs the question that when you're taking a $2 billion draw average, that impacts the fund's long-term viability too. When we make statements that an additional draw of 500 that is unstructured, 500 million unstructured, even taking the $2 billion draw is a huge policy discussion on changing the way that we're using those funds instead of just leaving it sitting in savings as an account. Isn't that fair to you?
Madam Chair, without question, I'll say even more broadly, for the life of the permanent fund, it has tended to grow faster than the rate of inflation. It has been a growing fund, not just because we're putting new oil money in it every year, but because we're only taking out of it a portion of its earnings. Once we flip the switch, to use a term, to using the earnings to run government in some way, the structure has to be such that the inflation is allowed to continue to happen, and there's going to be additional growth from the new deposits, but the underlying goal is to keep the real value whole. What this slide, number 8, shows is we also start losing the real value if we start taking additional money beyond that.
Assuming the rate of return that the actuaries have indicated. But if we exceed the rate of return, which we have over the life of the permanent fund, more like 8% above for actually the life of the permanent fund, and then if you go into the five-year realm, it's still above 8% rate of return, which is not meant to be argumentative at all, just a point that there are so many variables in this discussion to just highlight one is not appropriate. Alaska and Alaskans need to know that there are many variables in this system that different individual regions are affected differently by, and the formula spits out a different conclusion depending on where we turn those knobs. And I know the members at the table understand what I'm talking about with the rate of return. in our earlier discussion, a 0.5% equaled $300 million?
$200 to $300 million,
and we're talking about rates that have historically been over 2% above what we're talking about now. But on a three-year average, I want to make sure I put that on the record, it was more like 6.18 return, an assumed rate of return, or I'm sorry, an actual rate of return for the permanent fund. So it is trending down if you only look at the last 3 years.
Madam Chair, there's a lot of very positive features in the permanent fund legislation that passed your committee. One of them is the revisiting of those sustainable rates every several years. I believe you alluded to that this morning when Director Teal was speaking.
Thank you, Director Alper. Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for you, Mr. Alper. Do you believe that we have the right mix in our liquidity management statutes for the CBR? Do you think that's an exposure?
Through the Chair, Senator Michiki, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question. The CBR is obviously a lot smaller than it used to be, and it needs to be a lot more liquid. It was invested more aggressively when we didn't expect to have to use it quite so soon. I might need a little clarification on the question.
Madam Chair, just on the five-year expected spend, it just seems like that time horizon should be shortened so that we could enjoy a higher rate of return for the CBR. Just your slide talks about that exposure of a $250 million annual loss, and if it was invested more similarly to the permanent fund, you wouldn't have that. You could have your reserve account that had a higher balance without that exposure and liability of that earnings loss.
So through the Chair, Senator Michiki, the direction the administration currently has from the legislature on use of the CBR is the portion that isn't needed in 5 years can be invested more aggressively and get a higher rate of return. It's my expectation that should there be a broader fiscal solution passed that now suddenly reduces that exposure on the CBR, we would be able to transition it into a better investment portfolio that earns a higher return.
Commissioner Fisher.
But I also would just agree, Senator Michiki, that 5 years is a very long horizon, and probably, and for everyone's benefit that may be listening, the statute that governs the way the CBR is managed requires that money that is expected to be spent in the next 5 years is invested very cautiously in highly liquid instruments, and that probably is too long a time. I mean, that's something that I think we should collectively work together and think about how to ensure that we're managing that better.
Thank you. Other comments, questions from senators? Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So starting with slide 9 and really slide 10, we're getting into the guts of Senate Bill 4001 itself and what it does. And it is a flat rate wage tax. It is 1.5% on wages and also the earnings from self-employment. There's definitions in the bill that describes what that means. But it's a tax paid by everyone who earns income in Alaska, whether resident or non-resident. And it's taxed at the individual level, meaning a married couple where both partners worked, each would separately pay this tax. It does not tax certain forms of earnings and therefore is not a true income tax. For example, investments, retirement income, interest, dividends, those sorts of things are not under the structure of this tax. And from the convenience level and from the administrative level for as it impacts individuals, most individuals would not have to actually file taxes with the state of Alaska. It would be withheld from their check by their employer and be remitted directly by the employer, similar to the way Social Security withholding at the federal level is done, as well as the state's unemployment taxes are withheld by the employer and remitted directly. The only individuals with a direct tax-paying relationship would be the self-employed, who would have to do some self-reporting to us. There is a cap. That is a different feature from earlier versions of similar legislation that says, notwithstanding that 1.5% calculation, the tax cannot exceed an amount equal to 2 times the previous year's permanent fund dividend or $2,200, which happens to be the current year's permanent fund dividend, adjusted for inflation. So the greater of. Roughly speaking, anyone earning less than $147,000 a year is going to pay a 1.5% tax. The people earning in excess of $147,000 are going to pay the flat capped amount, $2,200. Roughly, we're talking about the top 5% of earners would fall under the cap. 95% of workers here, resident and non-resident, would be paying the 1.5% cap. And for the obvious question that immediately arises from that, how much money are we talking about? Between $10 and $20 million. That is the amount that would have been collected had that 1.5% rate been extended to all income and the highest earners. So whereas the bill is, we estimate, $320 million, without the cap, it would be roughly $330, $340. Of that amount, we would expect 15% of it to come from non-residents. That number is a little bit in flux every year. Non-resident employment goes up and down. We'll know that a little bit better once we start, but we're fairly confident with that roughly 15% number, which is around where the non-resident workforce is. And for most Alaskans, those earning less than $75,000, the tax is less than their permanent fund dividend. And the out-of-state residents, the non-residents, are actually paying, if you include the permanent fund dividend as a form of negative tax, and I know that's a controversial position, others might view it differently, but if you view the dividend as a form of negative tax, those earning less than $75,000 are paying less than they receive, and it's only, for lack of a better word, negative cash flow to the state for individuals earning more than $75,000 per year.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've not been a part of these discussions so much in the past, but can you tell me what is the rationale for not letting folks who earn more pay more? I need to understand that.
Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, I have a whole slide on the rationale of the cap a couple back, if you don't mind if I deferred the question. It's an important conversation. Broadly speaking, the idea is speaking to that portion of the population that says, I don't want to pay a tax, but I'm prepared to give up my dividend. This is in many ways structured to give the dividend and then tax it back.
Thank you, Director Alper. Senator Stevens, follow up?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
We'll wait for that additional conversation.
So a little bit on the development of the bill and how it came into form. Alaska taxed income in the past. We had what you would call a full income tax that was tied for most of its history to the percentage of federal liability from 1949 until about 1979. The bracket system changed along the line. The rate crept up over the years. But this, if you look at the historic revenue picture of the state of Alaska, especially in the years before there was substantial oil revenue, the income tax was among the largest, if not the largest, component of Alaska's revenue picture, how we paid our bills, how we paid for education, transportation, and the like. The personal income tax was repealed in 1980, along with the old school head tax and a couple of other taxes that we had at the time, after the oil revenue started coming in and was more than enough to meet the needs of ongoing government at the time. And that's been the paradigm we've been in for the last 37 years. Oil and gas revenue has managed to support 80, 90% of general government revenue in most years. Part of the reason we're here is that it simply is no longer able to do that. There was efforts to restore similar taxes or income-based taxes over the years. The furthest along what they call the Alaska Fair Tax, House Bill 303, that was an unusual bill because it worked its way through the House primarily as a sales tax, and then due to some concerns with how that would affect federal deductibility and the like, some members may have been around at that time. I know Senator Hoffman was. It was transitioned late in the game to an income tax, but it was an income tax with a declining rate at high income intended to replicate the effective tax rates of a sales tax. So it was an income tax trying to look like a sales tax. It did pass the House, and it was voted down fairly quickly by the Senate at that point in time. There have been other bills looking to bring up some form of income-type taxation since 2015, with the end state of that being House Bill 115 that passed the House during the regular session this year and came over then, and you, of course, remember it being voted down in the Senate during the month of May.
Director Alper, if we could pause.
Certainly.
Are there questions from committee members? Director Alper, I have one. Do you have the number that Alaskans pay in federal income taxes how much money is collected and sent from Alaska to the federal government?
Madam Chair, that is an excellent question, and I wish I did know that off the top of my head. I'm certain it's more than $300 million.
I'm certain yeah. It is also. The reason I ask that is because there's been this notion around the Capitol, at least, and in the halls, that use of the earnings to benefit all Alaskans. And we had a presentation here earlier where OMB Director Pitney took apart the entire state budget. And so very quickly, 50% of the budget is designated general funds. So that could be tuition, fish receipts, fishing licenses, DMV payments. 50% designated funds and federal funds are our budget, which is why we concentrate a great deal on the undesignated general funds. And then 50% of those undesignated general funds go out to communities. They are not part of state government. They are money that is passed through for other things that are important to smaller communities than a statewide look. And so we're looking at a very small portion of our budget then when we start looking at the services that we're providing that are specific to individuals like Medicaid services or like K-12 education. And the reason I ask the federal dollar amount is because, again, circling back, in this building, in these halls, people are saying that it is unjust and unfair to take from lower-income families a dividend that means very different things to that family than it might mean to the family, Mr. Alper, that you talked about that would be above the double the dividend take. And so I find it fascinating that we don't recognize that individual Alaskans are contributing, and they were contributing at a federal level, and then we receive that money back. And so from my perspective, I feel a little bit held hostage to some of the revenue discussion that we have to have that before we act to use the interest that we're receiving in a sustainable way. I know that's my issue. It may be others' issue, but that's why I'm asking that question. Alaskans are paying a significant amount of money to the federal government that are benefiting our population in different ways, in different regions, and understanding how that is related might be valuable to help solve the divide between this fairness question that we're all facing, because I do know and recognize that families that are low income use their money very differently or may be forced to use that money differently than families with higher income.
And Madam Chair, the main thing I would say in response to that is you've pointed out the essential role a permanent fund dividend plays in Alaska's culture, both symbolically and monetarily. It's essential lifestyle support for an important component of our population, and therefore very few take seriously the idea of completely eliminating the dividend. If we are going to maintain a strong, sustainable dividend, however, that means there's that much less that can come out of the permanent fund towards general government. Right. If we didn't need a dividend, well, that's another $700 million, let's just say, that would be balancing the budget, and it would be a much easier conversation.
Director Upper, thank you for those comments. The other thing I hope that Alaskans remember when we were flush in money is that under a previous administration, the legislature approved a double dividend, basically. Prices were high. We sent out to the people of Alaska an extra dividend check. While this is a conversation that is entirely in the reverse of that, when we had additional funds coming into the state, we made sure that those were shared with local communities and with individual Alaskans that were facing some pretty tough times.
Thank you, and I would agree. I hope we could touch on this conversation a few slides down also, when I have a couple of slides that look at per capita, state-by-state taxation, and there's an interesting exchange that happened in the other body's finance committee yesterday that I want to bring to your attention when we're back there.
Please continue.
So in many ways, Senate Bill 4001 is different than a true income tax. I know people look at that like it's semantics. So you're taxing income. Of course, it's an income tax. An income tax means something in federal law and in regulation and generally understood language. This doesn't tax the capital gains, the retirement earnings, the S corporation distributions, the type of pass-through earnings that go from a business to an individual. Also, the administrative structure, and I mentioned this in my opening comments, are based more on the school head tax bills. We're looking to tax wages and simply pass them through. We're not looking to dig deeper into the overall statewide income with the way this is structured. The structural concern with the head tax bills that have been introduced was there are stair steps in them that said if you earn under 20,000, it's one rate. If you earn 20 to 50, it's another rate. And there are some unusual marginal tax issues that occur at the transition between the rates. Someone might make another $50 and pay another $100 in tax, for example. So by making it a flat rate percentage, you get a similar effect without any of the unusual economic circumstances of the transitions between the brackets. This is also much smaller as an administrative burden. We don't require as much people, We don't require as much software. We don't require as much audit power to simply be looking primarily at wages. So the fiscal note is commensurately smaller. It doesn't require that individual filing. And then here's a technical definition. There are seven states that don't have an income tax. We're one of them. Nevada is another. And there was a wonderful article from Mr. Walczak from the Tax Foundation on their website. You may have met him. He's been to Alaska. He published it a couple of weeks ago, and he described how our tax work, and he compared it to a wage tax in the state of Nevada that's actually collected by municipalities, but it's a state tax, and it's a percentage of your wages above $50,000, and that's not considered a wage tax. That's not considered an income tax. And that's the closest parallel to what we're doing. Therefore, what we're doing shouldn't be considered an income tax. Obviously, people will disagree. Now we're on the slide that answers Senator Stevens' question, the thoughts behind the cap. And there is a lot of rationale to say, why are you creating a whole agency to collect a tax when you have another agency giving everybody money? Part of the reason is, of course, it's different people. The people paying the tax are at a different scale than the permanent fund, which is a flat amount for all eligible Alaskans. But there are many people, and then some of them are your constituents in all districts, who are prepared to give up their PFD but do not want to pay a tax. They're prepared to do their part to help operate government but don't want the idea of a tax. But as I said a few minutes ago, fully eliminating the dividend would likely be unworkable policy, would likely be challenging and be hard to find a majority that wanted to do that anyway, but it would cause undue harm in certain demographics of Alaska, and we are not proposing and would not support that. However, by putting that cap in there, it acknowledges that thought, that here's your dividend, and if your earnings support it, we are going to tax it back. If you're lower income and you don't have the earnings, then you're going to keep most or all of your dividend. If you're higher income, you're going to pay back your dividend, and by structuring it to double the dividend, we're sort of accounting for the dependents, the person in that working person's family who are also earning a dividend, and we're kind of taxing back their child's dividend as well to extend the parallel a little bit. So the hope is that this will be more, frankly, broadly acceptable. The governor more or less supported the House's income tax bill. The Senate was clearly not interested in going there, and we respect that. We are trying to find an in-between place where we might be able to get consensus on something that brings in the right amount of money without pushing the buttons that makes it unacceptable to the legislature as a whole.
Politics. Thank you, Mr. Alper.
Madam Chair, your words, not mine, but thank you. So the physical bill, the technical bill, is not that big. It is about a third the length of the House's income tax bill, in large part because you don't need as much definition about nexus and non-resident this and that. It's very straightforward. It's adequate to establish what we are taxing, or income earned in Alaska, and giving us authority to write regulations to define that in greater detail if necessary. We are not given free rein to make interpretations that one might find questionable. The multi-state compact, to which Alaska is a party, governs and limits what we can define and do. We are incorporating the Internal Revenue Code only where needed. there a broader income tax, including, say, Alaska's corporate income tax, incorporates all of the federal IRS code for corporations. I sense you have a question, Madam Chair, so I'm going to pause here.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Mr. Alpert, have you dusted off the where we were in 1980 with the school head tax, as far as the implementation procedures and, you know, do we have to reinvent the wheel, or have you looked at the code and from when we?
So through the chair, Senator Bishop, because so much of this is withholding and employer-based, we believe that there's a certain amount of piggybacking that could plausibly be done with Department of Labor. And I know as a former Commissioner of Labor, you're fully aware of their workload over there. The limitation is that federal government funds a lot of work of unemployment insurance, that a lot of their staff are federally funded and their workload is tightly prescribed by federal law. So we would need to find some workarounds, and we would need to, if we're going to involve them in the process, somehow be paying them for that. It's not like we could simply ask them to do it on top of their existing workload. But by and large, we have a structure in place for the wage-employed people to, other than the state. Now, the state is self-insured for unemployment, so we'll set that aside. But for the great bulk of working people in Alaska, their employer is withholding some percentage of their wages and then remitting it to the state with an employer match in that case on a quarterly basis. So the infrastructure is already in place. We would need to modify it somewhat, expand it, probably update the software. But, yes, there's a lot that can be built upon what already exists.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
The hard part of this bill, frankly, to add to what my answer to Senator Bishop, is not for the regular wage-employed people, but for the self-employed. That's where the regulations are going to be a little more complicated. We're going to make sure to define what is and isn't taxable, probably incorporate Schedule C, that sort of thing where people deduct their business expenses. And then there's going to be a tax return that they file individually. And not just them, but also, to a certain extent, wage-employed people might be able to file for refunds. The concern here is if a person has two jobs and their wages between the two jobs exceeds the cap, they might over-withhold, and then they would need a mechanism to be able to apply for a refund with the state. Refunds are a sensitive issue in the income tax world because of the possibility for fraud, sometimes fraud at a large scale from overseas hackers. So we have to be careful with that, but it's something we would build.
Director Alpert, Senator Bishop.
Just real briefly, and that protocol already exists within the Department of Labor, as you described with the UI employment for multi-employers, right? There's a repayment method at the department.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, there's a cap that the state adjusts every year. I think it's about $39,000 right now. You only pay unemployment insurance on the first that many dollars that you earn, and if you overpay, I believe there is eligibility for a refund. Thank you for pointing that out.
Please continue.
So the revenue itself, I touched on this a little bit before. We use the number $320 million. We're relatively comfortable with that modeling. If we're within 10%, I'll be thrilled. Because the effective date of this bill is January 1st, 2019, giving us a year to build it and implement it and outreach to the world of employers, software, QuickBooks, Intuit, TurboTax, people like that, everyone has to adjust their forms and structure to adopt whatever Alaska would pass. We're giving us a year to build it. January 1st, 2019 falls in the middle of fiscal year 2019. So in the fiscal note, you'll see the number $160 million for FY19, essentially saying that the estimated tax payments or the withholding tax payments that we get during the early months of 2019 will be about half a year's worth of revenue if you look at the fiscal year versus calendar year split. No actual returns will be received until 2020, the people who actually file an annual return. So if we are forced into a rapid implementation scheme, we would build the withholding parts first and the tax filing parts later, because we've got another year before any forms actually come in from individually employed people. We took the IRS data. We have new 2015 IRS data that we've received within the last couple of years, on Alaska's employment base. We had previously been working with 2014 data. So of the roughly 440,000 employed people, or let's call it individuals with Alaskan addresses who report income to the IRS, those people would be paying about $280 million under this bill, and then the other 40 roughly would be the non-residents. So just breaking them out into their income levels, which I thought is fascinating, a little less than 15% each, below $10,000 and between $10,000 and $20,000 per year. Again, these are individuals, not this certain estimation that does, if you have joint filers, as far as breaking that into multiple people. The plurality of taxpayers are between the $20,000 and $50,000 range. I think that's important to recognize. The next largest number, 107,000, between 50 and 100, and a much smaller number, above $100,000, and only 4,000 Alaskans report an income of greater than $250,000 per year. So, and this repeats the point I made earlier, about $10 to $20 million would come from those higher-earning folks that would otherwise be paying above the cap if the cap were not in place as structured in Senate Bill 4001. With any major legislation comes cost of implementation. This is not my favorite part to talk about, but these things don't run themselves. It will be a major logistical challenge. We need regulations. We need to design the software. We need to outreach the community. We need to hire people. We need to create, frankly, new types of state positions to a certain extent and create the work descriptions around them. So, and because we know that we don't know everything, first thing we would do is hire somebody, some sort of contractor to help us with a complete implementation plan, someone who's helped run a small tax like this in another western state probably, who would help us with an implementation plan. We could do for $200,000 or $300,000. We put $10 million in the fiscal note as a capital budget request. That's the one-time money that we believe it will cost to build the primary software system, the tax management system, that would be both the forward-facing, the outward-facing filing window for the taxpayer or the employer, as well as our administration file maintenance auditing module from our own side. To put that number in perspective, Madam Chair, the legislature gave the Department of Revenue $34.7 million in the FY12 capital budget to restructure our overall tax revenue management system, and we built essentially 20 of these in parallel for all of our different tax types with a commingled centralized administration, replacing a lot of old software, a lot of old siloed tax systems that we have since retired. We would expect to engage that same contractor and build a new major module on top of what we currently have. And then the staffing. We say up to 40 people. We believe we could probably do it for less, depending on how much interface and efficiencies we can gain from working with other agencies. The fiscal note was written under the idea that we at Revenue would be building a new agency, a new group from the ground up as a standalone item, $5.2 million with 40 employees. By the time we get to FY21, it's not... we don't have all of that in place until the money's already coming in. It's a gradual ramp up. And that the total cost of our fiscal note as written, 6 years of operating spending plus the $10 million up front, works out to just about 2.5% of the forecasted revenue. So 97.5% of what came in would be incremental general fund revenue to the state.
Director Alper, if you could pause for a moment. Are there questions from committee members? I have one. Can you compare this to the income tax that was proposed and the employees that were needed for a income tax versus this being a payroll tax where most of the collection is housed in other areas outside of state government?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the income tax fiscal note, the formal document that came over with House Bill 115, spoke of 60 employees, and we frankly were cautious on that. We thought we might be coming in on the low side, but there's enough sticker shock already. An income tax with the type of auditing activity is a big deal. This the 40, and I say it on the next slide, we think we might be on the high side. We could probably, frankly, do it with 30 if we can get certain things done right. But so we're talking half. And one of the issues is, frankly, the cap itself saves money because if no one's paying more than $2,000, there's less need to audit the high-income taxpayer to make sure they're filing accurately. Once someone's up in that higher income range, they're simply going to be paying at the cap, and there's not as much to look at.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Director Alper, one of the questions that you and I have talked about already, so this shouldn't come as a surprise to you, is the permanent fund eligibility and processing department now looks at quite a few aspects of a person's life and behavior over the year to determine their eligibility for their permanent fund dividend. To what degree possible is it to add this particular component to their job already as they're engaging into the personal business of Alaskans already?
So through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there are certainly, again, efficiencies and overlaps that will happen. The Permanent Fund Dividend Division is right down the hall from the Tax Division. I believe the main thing we would be able to commingle with them, which is a huge feature, although unheralded, is the dealing with physical paper. They have a large staff that, for those that still file in paper for their dividends, have to scan them and data enter them and that sort of thing, and we would have a similar need for an additional paper handling, what we call imaging and data management. A lot of what they do as they're the eligibility type people, they're determining whether you live here. They're determining do you meet the statutory definition of an Alaskan to be able to get your permanent fund dividend. This bill does not care if you're an Alaskan. It taxes everyone at the same rate. All we're primarily interested in is do you earn your money here in Alaska. So it's a different set of things that are looking at. So that side of the house is going to require different people.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow-up.
Thank you. So each quarter, as a business person, I have to list each of my employees, where they live with this responsibility code and exactly what they do, their exact wages, and then how many employees that I have on each quarter. And that's the state unemployment tax. So that is already uploaded on a quarterly basis. You can either do it via paper, but most people, I think, do it through MyAlaska. Why? That is already being reported. You can run a report and see where people live and how many wages that they're obtaining, and it's their employer that is reporting that, not the actual employee. So how is the audit going to take place, and how are you going to flag? I know I'm kind of drilling down, but the point is you're asking for 40 employees. You're estimating potentially up to 40 employees when there are already significant mechanisms in place that provide you, I would think, 90% of the data that you would need already.
So through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, most of the data for the wage-employed people, you know, we also have to account for those who are outside the system, including the 20,000 state employees and the self-employed, the business owners who don't earn their living through wages who would be filing. So we need people for that. We absolutely hope to piggyback on Department of Labor's data set and their record keeping. And even if the money were remitted through them and then passed on somehow to the Treasury, to the Department of Revenue, we would seek to find ways to do that. I don't want to get out ahead of the Department of Labor. They are not part of this bill, and they have their own agency that they need to run. But I believe there are certain collaborations that could absolutely be done for, let's call it, three-quarters of the population, the people who are regular wage employed, using their data and their interface. My sense is that their software might need an upgrade, and that's where the capital part comes in. Perhaps we can do both of them at the same time. And those are exactly the sorts of things we would be exploring once we had the mandate to do so.
Thank you, Director Alper. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So like I said, we hope that our fiscal note is too high. To the extent we can collaborate with the Department of Labor, that's where the 40 people becomes 30 people, and if we're lucky, possibly less. But I can imagine the face that my deputy director sitting behind me is making because he's been here longer, and he knows that these things take time and people, and I don't want to lowball this too much and promise you what we can't deliver. It is going to take people. Just to use a single example, the permanent fund dividend gets about 80% online filers, requesters right now, which means 20% still coming in paper. That's something like 140,000 pieces of paper that someone's got to physically deal with. We're going to be lucky to get that level of online filing, and just dealing with the paper is going to be a real workload. There's going to be an appeals process. There's going to be the refunds, which are there, and making sure the fraud protection on the refunds, and then supervision and public contact, and people are going to be calling up all the time with questions about the tax, and there's going to need to be a dedicated team to be able to answer those questions. So it's not small. It is. Our largest tax in the tax division is the corporate income tax. Depending on how you count it, we have about 18,000 customers at the most in that tax. This is going to be a larger number. So we have to view it in the context of what we're already doing and saying this would be the largest component administratively within the tax division. So things that we need to pin down that we don't know yet, and that's why we can't give you the defined answer. How much can we prevent individuals from having to deal with us and getting it all done by their employer? What is that self-employment filing system going to be? Is it a form? What sort of backup are we going to need from those people? What sort of submissions of both what we're going to have the right to request and what we're actually going to request automatically? I mentioned electronic versus paper filing, and then again, that interface, that coordination with Department of Labor is huge, and there are tremendous challenges just because of their federal funding aspect, but there's a lot of logical overlap. This is a flat rate wage tax. Unemployment tax is a flat rate wage tax, so there's a lot of similarities.
Thank you, Director Alper. When we were in the Anchorage area, we were more diligent on page numbers, so if we could try to remember to point to the page number for those that are following at home. We can see it here. Those that are watching on some kind of screen can see where we're at, but others might just be listening. So if they have the presentation, we're on slide 21 right now, getting ready to advance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 21, and the two before that were, I was talking about the fiscal note, were 19 and 20. And then the economic impact, the broader conversation about societal impact. What does putting a $300 million tax on the Alaskan people mean in the context of the economy? This slide talks more about what we've done so far as cuts. It's important to see that our economy has shrunk by 17%. That seems large. Most of that, when you're talking about gross state product, the value of what we export, a lot of that's in the value of the oil, of course. The value of the oil went down by half, let's just say. So the overall economy shrunk by about 17%. Total job losses, these numbers were updated the day before yesterday because questions came up in another committee. The 11,600 positions is the total decline from the peak month to the most recent month that the Department of Labor has records for. That's the overall state workforce. And what that translates to is 3.2%. To put that in other words, the unemployment rate is up 3.2% from when we were at our peak. Meanwhile, the state government job losses are in the neighborhood of 2,600 positions, which is about 11%. And that number, I believe, deserves an update. I think it might be as high as 2,800 positions. But, again, that's from a peak, and that is Department of Labor statistics of people employed by the state of Alaska. A number of those are university. There's seasonality issues, but these are a shrinking number of public employees, positions that have been eliminated where there used to be someone in them and now there no longer is. And then the map is just to show facilities closures, just to show that we really have shrunk our footprint during this period of downsizing, public health centers, prisons, various entities throughout the state, DOT, substations and that kind of thing.
Director Alper, if we could pause. We're on slide 23.
23, and again, I apologize.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Alper. So I want to go, the 2,600 state job losses, so there's, are those, because we have a lot of discussion around those. Are they real? Were those real people that were affected by a layoff? or were they empty PCNs? Because that you know, that discussion banters around in the building, and we get asked that at home when we go home and say, you know, we're working on reducing the budget. And so can you expound on that number, Commissioner?
This is Sheldon Fisher. Commissioner Fisher, maybe I'll take this question because we get the question a lot as well. And I want to distinguish a little bit between layoffs and between reductions, and then there's vacant PCNs. That we have a fair number of PCNs that are not funded, and I think there's some confusion about that fact. But this represents people that were receiving a paycheck and now are not. And some small portion of this, they were actually laid off, given a pink slip, and asked to leave. Majority of these are associated with attrition that we did not backfill. And so we've testified before that over the next 5 years, these are rough numbers, about 22% of our employees will be eligible to retire. That's been true for some time now. And typically in any period, about two-thirds of those that are eligible to retire actually do retire. And so over the last number of years, what has happened is there's been a large number of retirement, and many of those positions have not been backfilled. And so this 11% represents there's that many fewer bodies receiving a paycheck from the state.
Thank you for that answer.
Madam Chair,
thank you, Senator Bishop.
I want to thank Senator Bishop for asking the question. It's one of those debated items, and there's a lot of misinformation out there in the world. And the one thing I would just want to add to that is, and your committee writes the budget, you know this, but for the people watching, if you're eliminating a state position, this 6.5 months notice of that happening, the governor's budget comes out on December 15th, and it says the next July 1st, that position is going to be eliminated. If there's a person in that job, most likely they're going to look for another job. And there's always a vacancy, and like the commissioner alluded to, maybe their seatmate down the hall retired, and they'll slide over into that position. And what ends up happening is by March or April, that person's found a job, and the supervisor is not going to fill it. And then you get to July 1st when it's going to be eliminated in the next fiscal year's budget, and it looks like a vacant position. But really what's happened is that person's moved to another vacant job, and the position really is being eliminated. And this truly does represent fewer state workers. There's just no other way to say it.
Thank you, Director Alper. We're on slide 23 still. Commissioner, is it fair to say that the private sector uses attrition as a best business practice when they're facing huge deficits like we're seeing in an industry like oil and gas or others? This isn't something new that companies face. Could you speak to the private sector and how it has constricted versus how this administration has moved forward towards looking at jobs and providing a pathway that doesn't have as many litigations, lawsuits, a gentler, kinder way to tell people a direction and then, as Director Alper suggests, that they start looking for a job somewhere else?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to give a little background, most of my career has been in the private sector. This working for this administration is the first public sector job I've had. I worked for Hughes Electronics. I worked for Sprint Corporation. Then most recently here in Alaska, well, I worked for Alaska Communications. And you're absolutely right. It is much preferable to transition to right size through attrition. It's much less disruptive on your workforce. And there was discussion about that. Many firms will actually offer early retirement or some other incentive to induce people to leave as part of a restructuring or a right-sizing process. And so we didn't feel like that was necessary because we had so many employees that were on the verge of retirement. Employers, in my experience in the private sector, giving a pink slip is the last option you want to pursue. You kind of want to try to use whatever else you can to get your employees to leave if you don't need them, so that it's less disruptive on them and their family.
Thank you, Commissioner. And again, just for transparency for the general public, it is a business practice that's utilized. It's not trying to hide the ball. And when we look at a reduction of 2,600 positions, paycheck to paycheck, it is less spending and less folks that we have on the payroll that might need retirement or medical services from the state of Alaska. Is that accurate?
That is correct, yes.
Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. There's no one here at this table, I believe. I speak for the body that takes a 3.2% reduction or 11% reduction in job losses lightly. Those are real people with real families and real jobs, and I think we'd all like to see full employment.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Bishop. I think it's fair to note in this conversation that unemployment in Alaska is at an all-time high nationwide. We're number one, somewhere we wouldn't want to be, and that is with a 9% unemployment rate, which is adding to the stress of working families and those that are living in different geographic regions across our state. There is insecurity at home, whether people can find optimism and a way forward for their families right now. Director Alper, slide 24.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There have been a number of analyses from different organizations. This particular data set came from the University of Alaska at Anchorage, the ICER. Professor Gitabi did a presentation to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee during the regular session. But when you take money out of an economy in any way, there's going to be an impact. It's going to be reflected somehow in job losses. And what a lot of these analyses have tried to do is to calibrate it to say, what's $100 million in whether it's a tax or this another kind of tax or a budget cut or a dividend reduction or anything that comes out of the economy and into the government, what does that lead to in jobs? And a flat rate income tax, but I put the purple circle around there, just shows that a lot of these are roughly in scale with each other. There's no better or worse answer as far as the job impacts. There's other political, social desires as far as the mix of what mechanisms might be used. But a lot of these things worked out to be very similar to each other. You're looking at a sort of a high and low estimate when you see between 517 and 798 jobs per $100 million. The largest impact that they identified were spending cuts on things that directly hired workers. In other words, operating budget type spending. Capital budget a little bit less because there's a certain the multipliers are a little smaller. You're hiring contractors, some of them are out of state, that kind of thing. And then the various taxes all lined up surprisingly similar to each other. So again, no tax is inherently a good thing for the society, but some form of one is needed, and this one is no better or worse than other taxes as far as simple employment impact. And again, to your last comment on the previous slide, Madam Chair, we don't take lightly wanting to tax the Alaskan people. We know that they are struggling. We know unemployment is high out there. We're not doing this for any desire to take people's money. It's simply to have a sustainable government going forward, and I know you appreciate that.
Thank you. Director Alper, it looks like on slide 24 that a portion of the slide may be under the footnote. So I see a dark area that says low and then a partial description. What is your label on the lighter area?
Madam Chair, the low is then there's a little light box that says high is what we're missing. In other words, there's enough uncertainty and enough variables in this analysis, and I don't know exactly what Professor Gitabi's ups and downs meant, but in other words, somewhere between the black number and the gray number is depending on how certain assumptions go, is whether the high or low estimate is used. Mr. Co-Chair, should I continue?
Yes. Please continue.
So this is a screenshot from a group called the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy. They're a national group that has done work. They were working for the House Finance Committee earlier this session, and among other things, They looked at different tax models. This slide is up there primarily to show that it is more or less a flat tax. That why it's not 1.5% of all income levels is because it's 1% of it's what percent of all your income when you're taking 1.5% of your wages. At the lowest quadrant where the number is a little bit lower, I believe a percentage of their income comes from benefit payments, let's just say. And at the highest income levels, it's a little bit lower because a portion of their income is coming from investments and certain forms of non-wage wage income. But there are, although there are seven bars here, it's important to look at the little notes under them. We're really looking at the fifths of the income scale, the 0 to 20, the 20 to 40, the 40 to 60, the 60 to 80, and then the last three bars break up the 80 to 100 a little thinner into the 80 to 95, the 95 to 99, and then finally the top 1%. So this analysis was done based on comparable analyses of different $500 million taxes. That's the what that an analyst chose to use, so the rate is higher than we're proposing. 2.43% would get you $500 million. Seems about in scale if 1.5% gets you $300 million. The crosshatches that I'm on the two right bars, at the highest income levels, at the 95th to 100th percentile, the effective tax rate comes down because of the cap. And we overlaid that to show that the effective tax rate is actually lower than shown in this analysis because the highest income Alaskans would be benefiting from the cap. And then we put the note down there of what are we talking about. To get in the top 5% in Alaska, you're talking a household income of about $210,000. We have certain assumptions about translating from a household to an individual. Roughly speaking, there's going to be 1.5 working people in each of these households. So our $140,000 tax cap trigger works out to right about that $210,000 household income level. I'm moving on to slide 26. This is the bar chart of the 50 states that show per capita taxation. So the different colors are coded on the bottom there. The sales taxes are blue. The income taxes are red. You will see Alaska over there on the left. We are the only state with neither a sales nor an income tax. Some states have both. All other states have at least one. License taxes and fees are fairly straightforward. And when you see the yellow, when we say selective sales taxes, at the state level, what we're really talking about, Mr. Chairman, are excise taxes on things like motor fuel, alcohol, tobacco, things that are paid on selective items that are characterized by this analyst as a sales tax. So Alaska's total number below that black bar is roughly $500 per capita is paid by Alaskans to the state of Alaska. We are well lower than all the other states. New Hampshire is our closest peer. They have a very low and selective income tax, but then all the other states are quite a bit higher. And then the black bar is the shape of the tax that's proposed, $320 million, or in the neighborhood of $450 per capita, would keep us still slightly below New Hampshire, and we would remain number 50 on the per capita taxation level. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Mr. Alper, we've all seen this slide in several different packets over the last year or so. And one of the questions that I have, and it's rhetorical, it's just putting it out there. What other states can we find out have regional sales tax layered with their state sales tax? You know, does Ohio have a state sales tax, but do they also have different areas within their state, like Alaska does? Because we have sales tax in almost all of our regions other than Anchorage. And I know that's not factored in here. So I guess that's the question is, do other states have that? Do we know?
So through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the next slide attempts to capture local taxation in addition to state taxation, and I want to show that in a moment. We have a standalone slide that's not in this presentation that looks at just local taxation, which Alaska is unusual in that we are predominantly local sales taxes. The actual average sales tax rate paid by Alaskans is 1.7%. That's sort of an unusual number because no one's actually paying a 1.7% sales tax. What you have there are the higher sales taxes. We have 107 different sales taxes, 107 different communities in Alaska that charge a sales tax. Here in Juneau, it's 5%. That number is more or less average. And then you have the two largest communities, Anchorage and Fairbanks, that don't have a sales tax at all. So the weighted average per capita is that 1.7%. Other states do have local sales taxes, but they tend to piggyback on top of a state sales tax. So Seattle or New York City, say, might have a, half a percent or a 1% tax that gets layered on top of whatever their state sales tax is. What we have here is not typical at all elsewhere in the country.
Okay. Senator Shopman, can I? Okay. Thank you, and I appreciate the following slide. It doesn't have a slide number on it, but the comparable tax burden, state and local, with the additional general sales tax. I think I would just like to state for the record that Alaska somewhat has a tax that's not reflected on here in terms of health care. And when you start adding the total cost of living in Alaska when it comes to transportation, when it comes to the cost of energy, particularly in the rural areas, and then the amount of health care that we pay, we technically are, the cost of living is much higher than many states in the union. When you add it, that's one of the arguments against a tax, is that we're already pseudo-taxed in the healthcare industry. So it just, you know, this is a good slide, and thank you for including, yes, that one. But it's just important to note that our total cost of living is just extraordinarily high compared to other states.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I can't argue that. Other states will talk about their cost of living, especially some of the big urban states. The urban areas have very high housing prices. Alaska has relatively valuable housing and relatively high income that, compared to other states that go with it. Thus, our property tax is certainly above average among the states, although not grotesquely so. I wish I had added the slide to this presentation. Slide number, and the number, I really feel bad about that. Slide 26 is the state only. Slide 27 is the state plus the local. There's a local-only slide that we can provide the committee that I've presented elsewhere, and it shows just the standalone of local taxation. What we're seeing on slide 27 is the light blue is a new color. That's property taxes. And the addition of these, if you see sales taxes, the dark blue, Alaska, the leftmost purple arrow, which is the third in from the left, that's Alaska today, current law as we live. So that little dark blue is that 1.7% average sales tax paid by the so-called average Alaskan. Our property taxes are the light blue, and then the various license fees and selective sales taxes. And then if our $320 million tax were added on top of it, we would go from the third lowest combined to the 10th lowest combined, right there between Utah and Mississippi. So, but, and then further to the right, you could see New Hampshire. Like, on the local tax only slide, you'll see New Hampshire has very high local taxation. They have a relatively small state, live free or die. They don't have a strong presence in their citizens' lives, but local government is a much higher taxed, much larger part of the economy in the state of New Hampshire. And so the combined value of the two puts them far to the other side of us, to the more expensive side of us. But when we started looking at these property taxes, which are relatively high in Alaska, that is distorted by Alaska's oil and gas property tax. And we got confirmation that the data did include that amount. And it's roughly $450 million of the state's 20 mil oil and gas property tax that actually gets kicked back, shared with the local municipality at their own property tax rate. And out of the roughly $2,300 per person in property tax burden to Alaskans, $600 of it is that oil and gas property tax. So if we were to back that out, and that's highly unusual among the other states, if you were to take that $600 off the top, rather than the purple arrows, the left purple arrow being pre-tax and the right purple arrow post-tax, we would fall out about where the green arrows are. We would actually be the lowest tax combined state and local, and we would go to becoming the fourth lowest taxed if you added the $320 million wage tax on top of it.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, Mr. Alper, why you included the oil and gas property tax. I think it's a confusing addition to this slide.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, we struggled with how to include it. The property tax data that we inherited from others, we didn't do original research to do this, included all local property taxes. When we looked deeper, we realized that included this oil and gas property tax, which in some ways overstated and distorted the statewide total. So we just wanted to draw attention to it and say, if you back that out, we're actually even further down this slide than we thought we were.
As a follow-up, be careful what you wish for as far as pointing something out. So this contribution to school districts is based from a calculation on property tax. And should property tax then in real time need to be reduced by the numbers, the $600 per household or some 20%, 30%, that would make a huge difference locally too. Maybe I'm comparing apples to oranges, but I'm recalling something about full and true property value in the state of Alaska and a mill rate calculation for local communities. So I guess we'll do a little research on that to see if the oil and gas lease property tax should be backed out of the system.
And Madam Chair, and I think what you're referring to is the 2.65 mil required local contribution in the urban areas, that sort of the cost of entry to get the state to pay for the rest of the foundation formula. And that is absolutely within this light blue property tax data set.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm now on slide 27, 28, two in a row that did not have page numbers on them. So this is a different set of data that we're working from rather than looking at average people, and because there is no average Alaskan, and the municipalities are so diverse that they don't necessarily average well. This is a different analysis of the largest city in each of the 50 states in the District of Columbia. And so what we have here is the sum total of Anchorage's taxes, local and state, compared to the largest city in the other states. What's interesting here is Anchorage is of course the lowest, but and then we would go to being the second lowest past Cheyenne, Wyoming, if we were to layer this tax on top of it. Anchorage does not have a sales tax, so there's no indication there, and there's no distortion from the oil and gas property tax here, which is primarily distributed to those locations that have actual oil and gas activity, obviously. But the Alaska is down, and this is an analysis at $50,000 income. We have enough granularity to do it differently for different income levels. And so roughly the average citizen of Anchorage is paying $1,700 or so in state and local taxations over the years if they earn $50,000 a year. At the far end there, the residents of Newark, New Jersey, and Bridgeport, Connecticut, are up there in the $6,000 to $7,000 a year range, with the average being somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000 per year for large city residents in America. The next slide, I apologize. I thought we had one more here, the $100,000 analysis, which was lost from the back. A similar presentation would show Anchorage is about the second lowest at 100,000, and we jump past a couple of others to like the fourth lowest. So although the people of Anchorage rightfully feel highly taxed, they do have a pretty substantial property tax burden. The lack of a local sales tax and the lack of a major statewide tax in the aggregate put them at the low end of urban taxpayers compared to other large city residents in America.
Thank you, Director Alper. I believe they just passed a bill this week that increase their motor fuel tax to offset their property taxpayers' property tax payments for at least the next fiscal year. That may be under reconsideration. I'm not sure, but I believe it passed 10-1.
So, Madam Chair, that's the last slide in the pack, and so that's all the information I've brought to the committee. I'm happy to continue to take questions for as long as you would like.
Be careful what you wish for. Director Alper, are you prepared to do a walkthrough? We're used to having a high-level presentation of why a sponsor of a piece of legislation believes that they have the right packet, and we try to push where we can with questions from our experiences across the state in individual businesses. But are you prepared? I know that we have a sectional analysis. Can we walk through the structure of the bill and what the bill does versus why the administration believes we need it and sort of a historical perspective, but actually the mechanics of the sections. We have a sectional. If you need to read it, that's fine. But we like to let the folks at home or at least establish a record for the people of Alaska that they can look to understand the components of the bill.
Madam Chair, I am prepared to do that. I would ask for a moment to get the physical bill and the sectional analysis in front of me, and I would also ask Mr. Spanos to join me at the table.
Brief at ease. Senate, I'll call Senate Finance back in order. Still Thursday, November 9th, 2017. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska. The fifth floor in the Finance Committee room, and we have Senate Bill 4001 before us for introduction. We heard a presentation from the Department of Revenue from Commissioner Fisher, as well as Tax Division Director Ken Alper. Mr. Director Alper, we have Senate Bill 4001 in front of us. If we could structurally go through a walkthrough of the bill, so if senators have questions, that Alaskans can understand the proposal.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the at ease. Deputy Director Brandon Spanos is going to take the mic for the bulk of this part of the presentation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Brandon Spanos for the record, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, and I will go through the sectional analysis of the bill. The Section 1 is basically just some conforming language. I believe it was 2 years ago, the legislature passed a new amendment that allowed for electronic filing requirement for most of our taxpayers, with an exception if you file for an exemption. So our taxpayers now are required to file all their returns electronically. This gives an exemption for individuals that are filing electronically under this bill, should it pass. The next section, Section 2, implements the tax. It's 1.5%. With a cap, and the cap is there in this section, in subsection 011. And it also implements a tax on the net earnings from self-employment. And the self-employment definition, it refers to the Internal Revenue Code for what self-employment income is. And for basically that means if you're a sole proprietor or a partnership, or an LLC that files federally as a partnership, that would be self-employment income. And subsection 021 is defining what income from a source in the state means. In most states, when they tax income, they define a resident, or they differentiate a resident from a non-resident, because the U.S. Constitution allows states to tax residents to all of their income that they earn from whatever source. So if they earned income overseas, could still be taxed by the state because they're a resident. Because this is just a wage tax, it's fairly simple to determine where the income was earned, and it's just it doesn't need to differentiate, but it does still need to define what a source from within the state means. So that's what that section does, subsection does. Subsection 031.
Senator Stevens.
I just ask that you reference a page in the line.
That was on
yes.
Page 3,
yeah. Yep, that was a page, it went from page 2 to page 3, section 021. Now we're on page 3, subsection 031. And this subsection basically allows or defines how a business doing business in multiple states would apportion their income to the state, and it gives authority to the department to come up with regulations that do not or that are similar to the multi-state tax commission regulations that we currently have in statute. AS 4319 is how C corporations currently apportion their income, and we would anticipate to apportion that income similarly for businesses that are doing business both within and without Alaska.
Deputy Director Spanos, we do have online for those that are trying to follow a sectional analysis that is listed by section number. I'm not sure it references pages. So I'm happy to point out the pages as we go forward if it's not on your sheet.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, to just click Ken Alper here to clarify what Mr. Spanos said earlier, the great bulk of the bill is in Section 2. That's the part that's adding new statute that creates this new tax. So we're giving statutory numbers, which are really subsections within the larger Section 2. That's 90% of the bill itself is one section.
Thank you.
So on page 4, this would be subsection 041. It allows for a withholding for employers. So the taxpayers would be the individuals, the employees, but the employers would withhold and remit that tax to the state. And this subsection 041 allows for that withholding. Section 051 is for tax returns and payments for the self-employed. Obviously, their employer is themselves, and so they would need to file and pay the tax on their own, and that would be in the same manner that they file and pay for their federal return or those same dates. So they would, in most cases, April 15th, they would file and pay their taxes with the state. And that goes through page 5, or most of page 5. And then on page 5 also, subsection 061 is whatever accounting method and year that a taxpayer has federally, it would be the same for the state. So if they're a fiscal year filer federally, they would have that same fiscal year for the state. And if they're a cash basis accounting method for federal purposes, they would have the same for the state. And that just makes it much simpler for us because we do share information with the IRS, and we can compare that and use that same information. And subsection 071 on the top of page 6 is the section that allows for refunds, either if there was an overpayment, as Director Alper pointed out earlier in his presentation, if an wage employee has two jobs, it's possible that they would over withhold and go above the cap and therefore could file for a refund, or if a self-employed individual amends a return later and reports less income, they could get a refund. Subsection 081 is the report of payment for self-employed individuals. And so anyone that's required to report a payment to a self-employed individual for federal purposes would need to report that to us. That's usually on a Form 1099, and the state would get that Form 1099. So that's how we would determine who is self-employed. If you're making a payment to one of those individuals, that federal rule already stands. And subsection 091 is it authorizes the Department of Revenue to create forms and other regulations to administer the tax, and also to work with Department of Labor if there's efficiencies that can be made there. And we have talked to Department of Labor about this bill, and there are some efficiencies that could be made since they're already collecting a tax. However, because they are federally funded, they do have concerns about, like, audit processes and such that that they wouldn't be able to do without us paying for that, and they're claiming that they're pretty short on resources as it is to meet the requirements that they have federally to do those tasks. And I'm sorry, I don't know if I stated that was those were both on page 6. And on page 7, subsection 101 of the bill is adopting certain sections of the Internal Revenue Code. Some of them are penalties for preparers, and also requiring electronic filing for preparers. Subsection 1.
Deputy Director.
Yes.
Spanos, if we could pause there for a moment. Can you give assurances to this committee that the references that you're citing do not commit Alaskans to any other form of taxation that is outside of our control based on where this legislation is tying into the federal code, that in fact it's for refunds only or descriptive language that is consistent with employment issues, self-employment definitions? Are we hooked into a rate increase, anything that that we should be made aware of at this time?
Madam Chair, there are no rate increases in these sections that we would be tied into. I'd have to go back and look at each section to remind myself what they were. Some of them, I believe, are overstatement penalties. So if an individual were to overstate their income, understate their income by more than 50%, they would have a penalty associated with it. There were certain certain efficiencies that we saw in the Internal Revenue Code that we could benefit from that we proposed in this, but there was nothing that would increase the tax or have additional burdens outside of some of those penalties.
Thank you. We'll take a look at those. The reason I ask that is we're tied into, as an example, national electrical codes or plumbing codes, and sometimes the national organizations change things that drive direct costs into Alaska with increased compliance requirements. And so that's the purpose of the question when we're tying into the code. Is it something that can crank us up, crank Alaskans' costs up one way or another, or the state government compliance costs? So that's what I'm trying to get at. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, those sections, I believe, are all administrative sections.
Thank you.
Subsection 111, it authorizes the Department of Revenue to send certain confidential information to banking institutions in the case of either a refund or a payment. And subsection 151, these are both on page 7, it adds definitions for specific terms used in the section, like employee, employer, Internal Revenue Code. And then that brings us to page 8, section 3. It authorizes the Department of Revenue to implement regulations under the bill, and for the regulations to it gives an effective date for the regulations. Section 4 is an immediate effective date for Section 3 so that the Department can draft regulations before the effective date of the bill, and Section 5 has the effective date of January 1st, 2019 for the rest of the bill.
Thank you, Deputy Director Spanos. Are there questions from committee members on the structure of the bill? Do you need any additional information to understand how this bill operates? Thank you. Any closing comments from Commissioner Fisher or Director Alper or Deputy Commissioner Spanos?
Madam Chair, I appreciate you're in the committee taking the time to hear this bill. You know that we think it is an important part of a comprehensive fiscal plan for the state of Alaska, and we look forward to ongoing continuing conversations. I'm just pleased for the opportunity to be here on a Wednesday afternoon.
Is there anything else to come before?
Oh, it's Thursday, Madam Chair. See, I'm running. It's been a rough week.
That's all right. I just would like to thank the Commissioner, the Director, and the Deputy Director for presenting this bill. Obviously, a variety of Alaskans have different opinions on every section of the conversations that we've had, both in describing the gap that this piece of legislation is trying to help fill, and the different criteria that we've talked about over the past 10 days to 2 weeks on how these knobs turn either to burden additional Alaskans or, from others' perspective, add to the balance of a total fiscal plan. I just would say that I appreciate the additional information and the urgency that the administration took in providing us additional revenue forecasts from DNR and from Department of Revenue. I just wanted to say thank you publicly for that. I do want to wish a colleague and a friend happy birthday. Today is Senator Giesel's birthday. And on the floor, I took a brief of these because I was wondering if our majority leader knew that, and we do. So Senator Giesel was unable to attend the floor session today, so I know that she's watching all of the sessions because that's what Senator Giesel does. One of the most hardworking legislators that we have down in Juneau. There are many hardworking legislators, but my colleague Senator Giesel goes above and beyond on every occasion that I've ever seen her address an issue, and I just wanted to say happy birthday to her and wish her well. Tomorrow at 8 a.m., we'll be hearing an overview of the changes made to SB 54 by the other body, crime and sentencing, and the fiscal impact of those discussions that may not have been vetted fully inside of a committee action, but certainly were available to the other body on the floor as a committee acting on behalf of their entire body. So with that, we will look forward to discussions on the fiscal notes. That's why it's before us. We do not have a bill in our possession. We will not be discussing or debating 54, but trying to understand what happened on the floor of the other body in regards to the fiscal impact and how it is consistent across applications of the actions that they took. So with that, we're adjourned.